From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. Cities from the Gulf Coast to Sri Lanka to the Philippines are rebuilding after devastating natural disasters. What they build will shape their communities for decades to come. In this hour, we'll talk about architecture as a force for social change.
If you go to any design school in the country and you ask people, why did you become an architect? Okay, the top three reasons are, I want to design something that looks beautiful, right? I want to do something that helps the environment. I want to do something that really fits in the community. Okay, so you take those top three things. I want to help the environment, I want to do something in the community, and I want to do something beautiful. Right there is humanitarian design.
And the godfather of the American solar movement argues for the design not of solar houses, but of solar cities.
Can we bring the joy of nature into our buildings? I think that has to become a major objective of architecture. We've spent now decades in admiration for the machine and machine building and machine living. I think what we're now experiencing is a rejection of that. And the question is, what comes next?
Cameron Sinclair was only 23 when he founded Architecture for Humanity, a nonprofit charity that puts architects and designers on the front lines of disaster relief. In the 7 years it's been around, Architecture for Humanity has responded to hurricanes Ivan, Emily, and Katrina, worked on reconstruction in India and Sri Lanka after the tsunami, cleared mines and built playgrounds in the Balkans, and designed refugee housing in Afghanistan. Through all of this, Cameron Sinclair's message to the design community has been simple. Design like you give a damn. He told Steve Paulson he's learned a lot since he first set out to build homes for refugees from Kosovo.
This was the first project that we tackled. This was back in 1999. And we looked at the idea that while many NGOs, non-governmental organizations, were looking at refugees as they were streaming out of the country, we really thought about, well, what happens once they return?
And often returning to places where they no longer have homes.
Yeah. I mean, this was a time when we were starting to learn about ethnic cleansing and the scorched earth approach, which was you go in and you kill a family and you turn on the gas and you blow up their home. You eradicate any memory of that family. Now, what we had come up with was a design competition where you would develop a sustainable transitional shelter, a shelter that would last 5 to 10 years, that a family would have on their existing plot of land, and they would live there whilst they rebuilt their own home. So this wasn't about giving replacement housing. This was giving a family the opportunity to rebuild their homes. This idea came directly from the refugees who said, listen, I know how to build. My family's been building for generations. I don't want some tent. I want to be able to just have that opportunity. And that's something that we've been working with for a long time, which is the idea of changing the policy. I can build a beautiful building that's low cost, but if I can't change the policy, then that's only one building. If you can change the policy, you can literally change the lives of millions of people.
So to be effective, you've got to work with the political system.
Absolutely, absolutely. And we've been quite fortunate, at least overseas. If there's a disaster, I call it the Google effect. If you go to Google and you put in disaster and architecture or humanitarian design, we're at the top of Google, right? I don't know how it happened, but we are. So, you know, I'll be in the greengrocers, you know, buying asparagus and my cell phone will go off. And it's a cabinet minister of a country that's just been devastated. And they say, we were just on Google. We found your website. Can you help us? You know, which is a really kind of interesting, kind of takes you back a little that you can be in the midst of doing your daily chores and you have a world leader asking you for help. Internationally, we've had a lot of support. Nationally, it's a little harder. There's a lot more red tape in this country.
In the United States?
Yes. I mean, more politicians were former lawyers. So, you know, we live in a world of litigation. So to get to that level where you can talk seriously about housing issues, you have to jump through all these hoops. And I'm sure if there's any community members out there, they know exactly what I'm talking about. But if you're dealing in a country that's just been devastated, and the need has become so great. You know, when I was in Sri Lanka, within 2 days I was sitting in the Prime Minister's office. Here, you know, it's hard to get a meeting with the mayor.
Now, we were talking earlier about refugee camps and, of course, refugees. I mean, this is an enormous problem around the world. Mm-hmm. I've heard that you've worked on compostable tent cities.
Well, all sorts of things. I mean, we're doing a project in the next year called Rethinking Tent City. 1 in 7 people live in what we call slum settlements. That's inadequate housing, refugee situations, internally displaced populations. In 25 years, it's going to be one in three people. Okay, so we're not living in a world where housing is getting better. It's going to get remarkably worse. And that the city of the future is not going to look like New York City. It's going to look like Mumbai with illegal housing everywhere. So it's become really important for us to look at this kind of tent city situation. And we've had designers from around the world come up with these crazy ideas, one of them including a housing design that's impregnated with seeds, essentially, and that you live in this shelter until you can return. And you pack up this shelter and then you bury it underground and your first crops of the harvest come up. Now, it seems crazy, right? It seems like a crazy idea. But if the house is deteriorating at the same time, you have this instant first aid kit. And rather than your first aid kit being a Mars bar, you actually have crops. So you can actually harvest.
Now, I've also heard about something that just sounds totally remarkable to me. And I mean, some of these places we have been war zones, and they have all kinds of landmines mm-hmm. around. I mean, of course, if you step on those, you get blown up. Mm-hmm. And apparently you can plant flowers, wildflowers, that will detect the presence of landmines?
Absolutely, absolutely. There's a Copenhagen-based company that has been looking at, they've genetically modified a plant. Now, I don't like genetically modified plants, but when I heard about this, I was like, this is pretty neat. This plant, essentially, when you sow the seeds, it becomes stressed and changes color because of chemicals. And the chemicals and the gases emitted from the landmines actually make it turn red. So you can essentially plant a field, and wherever there's red, you know there's a landmine. The other project that I really love is called the Mine Wolf, which is a turnip farmer in Germany said, well, landmines are just like turnips. So he built a machine that was supposed to be used for harvesting turnips. And he essentially made it strong enough that it could withstand the blast of a landmine. And this thing just rolls over a field and picks up all these landmines and just, you know, blows them all up and gets rid of them. So actually, for me, the landmine is one of the biggest issues globally, because if you have three landmines and you stick them on an acre of land and a child steps on one, nobody will build on that land, no matter if there's two or 200 landmines, because the psychological issues associated with that are disastrous. I'm not sure what you do. I think the best thing you can do is support the demining activities that are going on around the world. The one that I really love as well is, I think it's called like Mines to Vines, which is a California-based organization that remove landmines and put in grapevines, and then they create wineries. I think it's fantastic. You know, this couple who created this essentially have created this baby industry, this small industry of wine growers around Afghanistan, you know. I'll drink Afghani wine if it helped remove landmines. So I think it's been really fascinating, some of the, you know, ideas that have cropped up out of this issue.
This is fascinating to hear sort of the ingenious ways that design can make our lives better, especially for the people who need it the most.
Yeah. I mean, you know, what you'll find if you're out in the field is that the community is some of the most inventive, creative people I've ever met in my life. I mean, some of the most amazing products and buildings that have been designed and developed have happened out of developing nations. A good example of this is in South Africa. We're currently doing something that, on the outlook, looks like a very simple project, which is building a soccer field, right? This soccer field is more than a soccer field. It's an area which has the highest HIV/AIDS rate in the world. And the community came to us and they said, look, we have an issue, is that none of the young girls in our community are neither educated nor do they meet with each other and can discuss these issues. So by the time they get to the age where, you know, they get into their teens, they all get infected. And this is why, you know, this problem is getting worse and worse. We need somewhere where girls could meet. They can talk about their issues, and perhaps we can introduce healthcare. So we came up with this idea of doing a soccer field, and the soccer field is going to be run by HIV/AIDS trained nurses. They're going to be the coaches of the girls' team.
So you actually have both a healthcare facility there as well as the soccer field.
But it doesn't say healthcare facility. This is a great thing, is to break that taboo of AIDS and to really approach a community, young girls who have not been really approached before. You have to do it very softly. So we're using sports facilities as a way to do that.
So how do you make a soccer field attractive so that these girls want to go and hang out there?
You know, it's extremely easy. We put up a notice on the side of a road that said, who wants to join a soccer League. Within a couple of weeks, we had over 300 people sign up. So just the idea of having that facility within the community is extremely important. Secondly, you know, the design that is being built in South Africa is a beautiful, actually, construction that utilizes, again, local technology. It's going to be built by the community. You can go to our website and see the design. It uses landscape terraces and has awnings and a beautiful clubhouse. And, you know, essentially any football team or soccer team in the West would be extremely happy if it was their venue. But, you know, here you have 9 to 14-year-old girls who have a field of their own. They actually called the field Siathemba, which is Zulu for hope, which I thought was very nice. So this is really how design makes a difference. These aren't just, you know, our projects. There are designers throughout the country that are involved in this, and they're kind of the grassroots hidden side of design. You know, there's Brian Bell in North Carolina who has something called Design Corps. There's the Rural Studio, which was Sambo Mokbi, and there's Red Feather that works on the Indian reservation. There's, you know, for every Frank Gehry, there are 100 designers in your community doing amazing work that don't want to be on the front cover of magazines.
Well, let me ask you about that, because I guess my image of, you know, young architecture students who go to school is they do want to become the next Frank Gehry. They want to put up the next fantastic art museum somewhere. But I'm sure there are a lot of people like that, but you're saying there's this whole other cadre of designers and architects who want to go out and make the world better.
You know, if you go to any design school in the country and you ask people, why did you become an architect? Okay, the top three reasons are, I want to design something that looks beautiful, right? I want to do something that helps the environment. I want to do something that really fits in the community. Okay, so you take those top three things. I want to help the environment, I want to do something in the community, and I want to do something beautiful. Right there is humanitarian design. I mean, when you go home and you watch CNN or Fox or whatever you decide to watch, and you see kind of this war and starvation and, you know, things like Darfur and tsunami, and you begin to think to yourself, well, wait a minute, all I do, if you strip away all the hype and everything, all I do is provide shelter. So why wouldn't I provide shelter to those who need it most? And this is a question that thousands of designers have asked themselves, and they've emailed us and said, can we do something? So we're just trying to act as that conduit.
Cameron Sinclair is the founder and executive director of Architecture for Humanity. He spoke with Steve Paulson. You could say that America's gift to 21st century architecture is the McMansion, in which case Japan's is the very small home. The hottest new design craze in fashion-conscious Japan is for houses that go beyond small to tiny. We're talking 1,000 or even 500 square feet of space for a couple or even a family of four. Sound impossible? American architect Asby Brown lives and works in Tokyo. He's published a book of photographs that shows some of the best new, small Japanese homes, which, he says, represent a return to the roots of Japanese housing.
Japanese homes, on average, were always fairly small. In the Edo period, which ended, you know, a little over 150 years ago, the average town dweller was living in about 250 square feet. They had these tiny, tiny tenements, and the entire family's living there. And that was like three-quarters of the urban population.
I mean, even for small people, yeah, that is not a lot of space. Yeah,
they were always that way. And a lot of the characteristics that distinguish the better of the houses that I'm looking at in my book, certainly they're very traditional characteristics. Things like using the area under the floor for storage, putting things away. Of course, bedding was always, you know, futons, and they were always rolled up and put out of the way and making the room usable for something else. Cabinets and boxes and shelves have always had a wonderful intricacy and pure functionality in Japan, nesting boxes and things that you can take out when you need them and then put them out of sight. Yeah. There's also one other very important thing that strikes me about many of these houses, and they're very, very modern in appearance, very, very spare, almost, you know, minimalist. And instead of having a lot of possessions on display, you know, they're doing this Japanese simplicity. And one pot, you know, one small cabinet, one beautiful treasured object instead of having a lot of things that sort of seemed good at the time.
Well, so, it does seem to flow through all of the pictures. You look at these places
it
and
does.
Think
it's
that
partly
the junk
selection.
In my house would fill these houses.
Right. The junk in all of our houses would, and how can you get rid of it? And that's funny, you know, because I'm not trying to, you know, do a kind of a spiritual life advice thing in this book. It's about design. It's about sort of practicality and functionality and beauty. But speaking with the various homeowners has been really, really interesting. There's one house called the Saginomiya House, which is one of the first ones in the book, and it's a two-story house. The occupant is a widow, and she's actually, you know, well off enough that she could have built almost any kind of house anywhere she wanted, but she decided she wanted this small house, which is, you know, less than 1,000 square feet, and devoted the entire first floor to a party space. And
is that the one with a 7-foot square kitchen?
That's the one. But the thing about this woman that really made me sigh was when I asked her about her closet. This house has a small walk-in closet. And I'm thinking of my own mother-in-law. They're almost at the identical age, and my mother-in-law has clothes that she's kept for 30 years but doesn't wear in her closet. She has several large closets, and they're all full. And I said, well, what about you? What do you do about the clothes? And she said, oh, I give it all away every year and buy new ones. So she, not well, maybe it's she has enough money to do that, but she gives it to charity. Yeah. And keeps the few things she really likes and just avoids getting the stuff she doesn't need.
What is it about these houses that makes them feel so much larger, at least in the pictures, than the square footage would seem to indicate that they are?
I'd say the technique that has the most impact in that respect is what I'd call the soft division of space. The architects have found ways to separate the different areas in these homes without building walls necessarily. Many of them are of the nature of a large open room with some raised floor area for perhaps a dining area or a kitchen, some part that has suddenly a tall but narrow atrium over it, and that is sort of delineating a particular place to sit in the living room. I see the use of quite a lot of curtains, lighting that both lends an identity to the areas, makes it clear, you know, what they're for, and also activates the space, makes it feel less confined because the light is moving through and playing off the walls, etc.
Well, there's some interesting things that they do with light. Mm. There's one that I remember a picture of what looks like a cupboard on the wall, but the light must be behind it. It looks almost as though the box
that's
is floating.
Right. I believe that's the Ambiflux house, which is a very unusual house.
Now, that's the tall, skinny one, right?
The tall, skinny one. Is that the one we're thinking of?
And I
think the cupboards.
So, yeah.
In the living area, yes, they have a lighting concealed behind it, and it has sort of a dual thing. Plus, the way the architect designed it, these cupboards seem to be floating. When the lights are on, it's like it's almost like a little science fiction movie, you know, this hovering box, you know, filled with shoes on one side.
Yeah. That Ambiflux house is interesting in other ways, I think. It's tall and skinny. Floor space, and I suppose you get it, it's like rooms stacked one on top of another.
That's right. It looks more like what we call a pencil building in Japan, where the lot is only, you know, about 30 feet across. As development has proceeded in the Japanese city, you know, they've built up, but the lots are still very narrow. And in fact, the two lower floors are rental space. One has, I think, a shoe shop in it, and the other one is some kind of gallery. You enter actually from what's the third floor, and when you go in, there's an atrium that goes up, you know, four stories. It's spectacular. There's beautiful, light, cantilevered stairs that climb the walls. It's like a medieval tower in some ways, but reinterpreted in modern terms. And, of course, the family has children, and they're running up and down these stairs. It's a couple of lovely daughters, and they're running up and down. I'm sure they're getting a lot of exercise. And all of the rooms are open to this atrium. There's no real walls, you know, separating the bedroom, etc. And the light comes from the skylight, which is the entire ceiling. I mean, the whole
thing is combine all to pull your eyes up so you don't concentrate on how little floor space there is.
And, you know, exactly. You don't feel the walls.
We were talking about lighting in some of these houses. They have used lighting in ingenious ways. There's one, isn't there, that has translucent walls?
That's right. That is a house called Natural Wedge, designed by Masaki Endo. And this is one of the interesting houses in terms of structure. This house is based on a steel trusswork. It's a beautiful, delicate, sculptural thing, white-painted, delicate trussing all through the house and including the walls, which are sheathed in glass. Of course, at nighttime, the entire house is illuminated like a lantern. It's beautiful, but the walls are glass. And, of course, not transparent. It's translucent. And, you know, to make glass walls, you know, and have the light come through, then you have to think about a lot of other things, such as insulation. The architect spent a bit of energy hunting down appropriate materials that were translucent. He found a kind of polyester fiber fill that's in a kind of nylon sheathing, all of which is translucent. So that's what's inside the walls. It's a remarkable house, like a giant wedge, and light comes in from every side, and it makes you feel like you're floating.
You've talked about the materials that are used and the ways in which houses are stacked and about how things flow outside. There's another house I was fascinated by that essentially has one wall that looks to be removable.
That's right. The Engawa house, yes, it's a very wonderful house. It's essentially a large rectangular box, and the interior is totally free of obstructions. And one side of the house faces a garden, which is bounded on the opposite side by the parents' home. So the couple wanted to build a house to make a family compound, and both houses would share this garden. And what the architects did was make one wall completely openable by means of, you know, fairly conventional, you know, heavy-duty sliding glass doors. There's about a dozen of them, which, you know, slide back to open this wall. And the house is, you know, again, less than 1,000 square feet. It's about 845 square feet. And this family, you know, this is something I've noticed, that many of the houses have not included sofas and those kind of living room furnishings, but center their life around a table. And this house has a remarkable table that's about 10 feet long. And all the family life takes place around that table. It's really, really beautiful. Wow. And it fits with the house very, very, very nicely.
What of all this has changed the way you think about design as an American who spent a lot of time in Japan now?
Well, what has been very interesting is to see the interest on the part of Americans and others from Europe, and I've even had interest from Hong Kong, etc. People seem to be ready to rethink their lifestyle a bit and to question the megalomania that's driving this phenomenon of McMansions and maximizing the size of everything. I find it very nice to be in a small little cozy room with a good book, and that book becomes my entire environment when I'm in it. And I think that kind of beautiful mental space is probably the most central requirement for really living in a small house. And I think a lot of Americans would be able to appreciate this kind of lifestyle as well.
Asby Brown runs the Future Design Institute in Tokyo. He's the author of The Very Small Home, Japanese Ideas for Living Well in Limited Space. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. When people in California talk about the big one, they're sharing their worries about something that hasn't happened yet. But they're remembering San Francisco in 1906. Between the earthquake and the fire that followed, there was almost total devastation of the city. Simon Winchester tells the story in a book called A Crack in the Edge of the World. The real problems came, he says, not from the quake, but from what happened next.
Two things happened. The fire chief was killed. Dennis Sullivan died in his fire station, scalded to death by steam from a broken radiator. So the fire department was leaderless, but much more important than that, it was waterless, because all the water mains ruptured and they were completely powerless to do anything about it. And so some very tough decisions had to be made about how to deal with this fire. And that, to my mind, is the most extraordinary thing about what happened, particularly when you compare the reaction of officialdom to what has recently happened after Katrina.
Well, speaking of officialdom, in San Francisco, there was, prior to the 1906 earthquake, pretty broad corruption in the city, which can't have done the city any good when the moment came when it needed most to have a leadership structure.
Well, you wouldn't have thought so. And yet, And yet quite the reverse happened. I mean, just very briefly what occurred. The earthquake happened at 5:12 a.m. on that Wednesday morning. One of the people bounced out of bed was a pretty appalling soldier called Frederick Funston, who had essentially been demoted after a pretty appalling career of violence and brutality in the Philippines, brought back to America and given the job as number two in the San Francisco garrison. The number one, General Greeley, was away at his daughter's wedding. Funston was bounced out of bed and realized instantly he needed to act. So he didn't care about the legality of what he was doing. He wrote a note to his adjutant down at the Presidio, sent someone on a horse galloping down there and said, summon all available soldiers, put them in full battle gear, march them through the ruins and the fires, and make them available to the mayor of the city. I mean, you can't these days just casually give federal troops into the custody of a city mayor, but Funston did. I mean, astonishingly fast reaction.
It is, and I guess the lesson isn't clear from this, although maybe the lesson is clear that we need people who will act without regard to...
The legality. I think that's one of the problems, yeah. That this... We're not here to talk about Katrina, I know, but everyone was looking over their shoulders, is what I'm about to do legal? And it inhibits people from taking the kind of bold decisions that in the moment of a catastrophe seem to be necessary.
How did the city begin to recover? Because this is not something from which you can do anything with all the best of intentions and all the help in the world in any very immediate fashion.
Well, it was a classic example of the business of San Francisco is business. I mean, it was a city that its commercial baronies decided it's got to get back onto its feet pretty quickly. And in doing so, they passed up a chance for the city to become architecturally one of the gems of America, because there was this town planner called Daniel Burnham, who essentially had mapped out Washington, D.C. I mean, the mall and all those things in Washington are part of Burnham's great scheme. Burnham was commissioned in 1904, 1905 to lay out a plan for San Francisco, which, after all, after its gold rush rambunctiousness, had really achieved the role of the imperial city. I mean, this was the city from where the Great White Fleet went westwards to dominate the Pacific, to have the colony in the Philippines, to trade with China, trade with Japan. America wanted a grand city on the West Coast. And so Burnham was called in to design one. And his design, which was oddly enough delivered to the mayor of San Francisco the day before the earthquake, was full of great boulevards and fountains and reflecting pools and statuary. It would have been a grand city. But they didn't. They immediately said, no, we can't be bothered with all this marble and all this folderol. We must rebuild the city on the old lot lines and just get back to work. And so they did. And within 2 years, you'd almost not know that the city had been hurt. And it was.
But was there at least any effort made by the people who rebuilt the city to make it stronger, make it better, make it different from the city that it had been before? Because you have to assume, having one of these events, there could be one day another.
Yes, and it has to be said that the California Earthquake Commission, under the leadership of this scientist called Andrew Lawson, did determine that he identified and indeed named the San Andreas Fault, and realized that that was the mischief maker that caused all the problems, and that it was likely to cause a problem again. But they did make the building stronger, and they did take precautions. They built flexibility into the fire water system, and they put big tanks under the road junctions. But the die was essentially cast because it coincided, the post-earthquake period, with the ascendancy of Los Angeles to the south. And there is one harsh reality, leaving aside the economic reasons for why Los Angeles became big, which was, of course, the film industry. The reason why Los Angeles became the capital of California, I mean the economic capital, obviously not the political capital, derives from a simple reality, that San Francisco lies exactly on top of the San Andreas Fault and therefore is theoretically prone for the rest of its existence to earthquakes, whereas Los Angeles has a swarm of lesser faults, but the San Andreas, the big mother, is 50 miles to the east, runs through, you know, Indian Wells and Palm Springs and places like that. It does not run through Los Angeles. And so Los Angeles is, in relative terms, a much, much safer place.
Is the world a safer place for this event having happened and been so clearly recorded?
No. Because of the cool indifference of the world to humankind, we now know why earthquakes occur. We know why earthquakes occur in California. The Pacific plate moving northwards at an inch and a half a year, scraping past the North America plate, friction not allowing it to for decades, and then suddenly it moves and that causes an earthquake. But knowing this does not allow us to predict, and that's the big problem. And when Art Agnos, one of the mayors of San Francisco, said rather testily to a geologist, "Look, you people are always going on about how dangerous our place is. Until you can give us 24 hours notice of an earthquake, just go away and be quiet." But the Earth has got this massive indifference and will keep on moving. And if we choose to place cities on top of the places where it does move, then we better woe betide.
But if in all your research you haven't discovered by now that people will want to live in a place as beautiful as San Francisco, even if there is the danger of an earthquake, but every morning they get to look at one of the most beautiful spots on Earth, well, then you haven't learned very much, have you?
Well, indeed, we certainly haven't. But there is a sort of broader reality, which I find very interesting, that in sort of old countries in the world, I mean, the European nations and Asian countries, our great cities are where time suggests that it's reasonable for them to be there. I mean, London, Paris, Moscow, Peking, Berlin. They're thousands of years old, and they're in seismically stable places, not afflicted by extremes of weather. And so it's reasonable that they should stay there. But by the same token, these same countries are littered with the ruins of cities that were built where they should not have been built, like Pompeii and Herculaneum and Petra and Heliopolis and Ayutthaya in Thailand. And we as tourists go and look at them and are awe-inspired and look at these ruins and amazed at the civilizations that built them, and we wonder idly why they're not major cities anymore. America, though, is a country without any ruins. It's got a few ghost towns in the West, but it has no ruined cities because America is young enough that it can put its cities down where it jolly well pleases, except for this cool indifference of the planet. And I wonder whether in 200 years' time, if you look at a map of the United States, whether there might not actually be some ruins that tourists go and visit. One of them, of course, obviously New Orleans, which when you think about it, it is sort of stupid to build a city 20 feet below sea level between a river and a lake in a part of the world that's afflicted by constant hurricanes. Similarly, Phoenix, Tucson, even Las Vegas. I mean, there is no water there. Sooner or later, that reality is going to catch up with people. And I cannot imagine, I mean, not many world cities are built in the middle of deserts. I can't imagine tourists going to see the ruins of Phoenix in future years and, you know, being awe-inspired by the relics
by the
of
dust.
Walmart, yes, or something. But then what of San Francisco? I mean, a very, very dangerous part of the world. Can it survive? I think it can if it learns a lesson from Japan. That's the one world country that has learned to accommodate to earthquakes.
Well, and Japan has had no choice if it wishes to continue to be a country because there are no seismically stable places on the Japanese islands.
Well, precisely. And yet it has managed to. It has managed to live to accommodate. It has competent people in every prefecture, every city. It's got emergency supplies. Its buildings are toughly built, and its people are trained, relentlessly trained on what to do in the event that the earth starts shaking. In California, regrettably, they're still in denial. It's far too easy just to open another bottle of Sauvignon Blanc and pretend they're not there.
Simon Winchester's book is called A Crack in the Edge of the World. There are a lot of things we might learn from ancient architects. Before air conditioning and central heating and electric light, people who built houses knew a lot more about designing with nature than we do. They paid attention to the transit of the sun, to the cardinal directions, to the seasonal rhythms of light and dark. They built green houses long before anyone coined the term. Today, architects and urban planners are rediscovering what our ancestors took for granted. Ralph Knowles is one of the godfathers of the modern green design movement. He founded the University of Southern California's Solar Studio and taught there for many years. Now retired, he's just published his 9th book on green design. It's called Ritual House, Drawing on Nature's Rhythms. Steve Paulson asked him, why go to so much trouble? Why not just air condition everything?
Interesting question. Why not? Why not air condition everything? And the answer, of course, is if we don't learn somehow to connect our buildings to the basic rhythmic changes of nature, I think we're in big trouble. We've got two things going here. One is an enormous shortage and potential shortage of energy. The other is population growth. In 1950, only New York in all the world had 10 million people. By the year 2000, the number of cities was up around 15 or so that had 10 million or more. And one of those had 20 million, Tokyo. By 2015, there will be 25 cities in the world of 10 million or more, 6 to 9 of those of 20 million. So we've got these twin pressures of a lack of security of our energy supplies and a growing urban population. So how cities use energy is going to determine how most energy in the world will be used. We've got to learn somehow to adapt the growth of these cities to use the sun as a source of energy. It's, after all, available to us at latitudes all the way from far northern Europe, which is at 50 degrees north, to 50 degrees south, and every major city in the world lies within that band. There are countries that are moving much faster than we are. Germany, for example, has what they call a solar cities movement, in which whole cities are adapting the ideas, the planning procedures, the policies, and the design procedures to use the sun as a source of energy.
So what are some of the ideas being tossed around about how to use sun more effectively in the design of cities?
Well, the first thing you need, of course, is solar access for buildings. And I've been working for years on an idea called a solar envelope, which represents the largest volume you can put on a building site without overshadowing your neighbor. It's essentially a requirement for zoning that limits the height and shape of buildings so as not to overshadow your neighbor.
And many architects in previous centuries understood these principles. I mean, you write about the great churches of Western Europe and how they were designed with the sun's progression in mind.
I think there are two things about that. One is they didn't have mechanical systems, no air conditioning, and so on, so that they had to somehow learn to live with the elements. The other aspect of that is if you learn to live with the elements and you do learn, you're responding not to a fixed condition. The sun does not stand still in the sky. The winds do not blow constantly from one direction at a given rate. They change, and they tend to change rhythmically and therefore predictably. So what the Gothic architects were doing was responding, for example, to sunlight coming through stained glass windows, entering the nave, entering the transept. Going back to the geometry of the sun, in the wintertime, the sun is coming low from the southern sky. So they opened the west windows of the nave to that low winter sun. The summer sun is high in the sky, so it barely gets in. So they were responding to that basic rhythm, a seasonal rhythm of the sun, primarily in the nave of the church, where the transept catches the morning light from one side and the afternoon light from the other side. So there was a basic diurnal rhythm that was at work in the transept. They learned to use the rhythmic ways that the sunlight entered those great cathedrals to enhance the quality of the space and to reinforce the rituals that were going on in the church.
Well, it makes you wonder how we respond to that emotionally. I mean, especially given the whole sense of ritual that's so powerful in a church like a Gothic cathedral.
Sure. I've thought a lot about that. I've sat for long periods of time in cathedrals to watch the sun move, to watch it move differently in the different spaces. And I finally decided that while a tourist is not going to appreciate that, the people who live there, who spend time in that church, who come back maybe daily or certainly they come back weekly or monthly, they're going to be aware on some level. They may not be able to describe it to you, but surely they're going to feel it, and it's going to affect their, not just their bodies, it's going to affect their souls.
And didn't the Native American cliff dwellers in the Southwest also have a fairly sophisticated sense of solar design?
Yeah, they certainly did. If you look at something like Mesa Verde, there are many south-facing caves at Mesa Verde, and what happens is that the low winter sun enters under the brow of that cave and heats and lights the cave in the wintertime. In the summertime, the sun, as I said before, is high in the sky and it doesn't get into the cave. So you have a natural air conditioning system in the summertime and a natural heating system in the wintertime. That principle can be applied to buildings. We can design buildings that absorb the heat in wintertime from the sun and that keep it out in the summertime. So these are basic principles that we've got to employ. In many cases, we've got to relearn them. They've been around for centuries and centuries, thousands of years, really.
So for those of us who are not architects or urban planners, what do we do with this kind of thinking if we want to incorporate nature's rhythms more into our own lives?
Part of that, I think, is, as all things educational, schools of architecture have to start thinking about adaptations to nature other than bigger heaters and bigger coolers. We've got to learn how to design with nature. And it's for two basic reasons. One is energy. And I think the other is a less well understood and less talked about aspect of it, and that is the quality of life. Can we bring the joy of nature into our buildings? I think that has to become a major objective of architecture. We've spent now decades in admiration for the machine and machine building and machine living. I think what we're now experiencing is a rejection of that. And the question is, what comes next? If we reject the modern movement, postmodern movement, the deconstruction movements, all of these styles that isolated us from nature, if we reject those things, where do we go? And the answer has to be that we have to relearn how to live with nature. There could be many ways to do it, and there will be many answers to that, but it's the next big task.
Ralph Knowles is Professor Emeritus at the University of Southern California's School of Architecture. He's written 9 books on solar design. The most recent is called Ritual House, Drawing on Nature's Rhythms. Steve Paulson spoke with him. When we come back, what can science tell you about how to arrange the furniture? You'd be surprised. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. You ever had the experience of being out of sync with your home? You open your front door and trip over a jumble of boots and hockey sticks. You look at your living room and realize your grandmother would be very comfortable in it, but you aren't. Or your friends suggest there might be a more original color choice for your walls, something other than white. And the problem, of course, is that it's one thing to buy a house, it's quite another to make it a home. Well, science writer Winifred Gallagher has come to the rescue of those of us who are decor-challenged. In her new book, House Thinking, she writes that behavioral and environmental science can teach us quite a lot about how to make a house a home. Gallagher collected the best of this advice and, along the way, rethought her own home, room by room.
The first thing that really struck me was the entry, and I think this is a problem for a lot of us. The entry to your home should be a very, very special place. So what a good entry to a home should say is you have now left the mad, wild, crazy world behind you, and you are entering this wonderful private refuge. And what a lot of our entries say, I'll talk about 2 different types. In the city, people who live in apartments or smaller houses don't have a lot of space. And the entry to their homes tends to be a dumping ground. It's where the recycling goes and the rubber boots and the kids' backpacks. And it's the exact opposite of the message that you want to send to yourself and to your friends when they enter your home. Now, in the suburbs, and most Americans do live in the suburbs, it's a car culture. And suburban houses, all of them, have nice front doors with often a nice entry hall and maybe some pretty appointments in the hall. But the only person who ever sees it is maybe the UPS man, because everybody else drives up the driveway, often right smack into the garage. So here's your entry experience to your home. You drive into the garage, you get out of your car, you open a metal utility door that goes into the laundry room that leads you to the kitchen. This is hardly saying I've left the mad, stressful world behind and I'm now in my wonderful sheltering private refuge.
Well, let's move on. I don't want to spend the entire time in the entryway to your house. Where do you go next? Most of us, I suppose, would go straight into the living room. Is that true for
you too? That's right. Yep, that sure is. And the living room is the most expressive, the most personal room in the house. Even in very simple houses in early colonial America or in parts of the Third World still, where people, if they have two rooms, one of them is the room for good. So it's an important place for you to express to yourself and to your friends and family who you are, where you came from, and what you value. That's all kind of on display in the living room, in the kinds of things that we put there, whether it's bronze baby shoes or, you know, a nice painting or a collection of pottery that you pick up over your vacation. Second, it's a social room. It's a room that should say, in our home, we welcome friends and family. We value people more than televisions. If I could wave my magic wand doing psychological renovations of American homes, really the main thing I would do, if not banish the television set from the living room, at least put it off to one side and down low so that the living room doesn't look like a church where the television is the altar and you're all lined up in front of it worshiping the great God of TV.
Right, where it's not the main thing that's there.
Sitting there staring at a flickering screen. It's the place where you should be talking to people and curled up with a book maybe, or yeah, watch television, sure, but don't make it the focus of your room.
The same sort of thing happens when I look through magazines, and we do, you know, we look at our house and we look then in magazines and see pictures of kitchens, for instance, that look so appealing until you begin to think about what they would actually be like if you were to use them. They're huge, and places that look like you could put a whole restaurant staff in them.
Well, yeah, a restaurant-caliber kitchen is now a big, big status symbol in America. It's sort of like back in my youth in the 60s, maybe it was having like a big Cadillac or something like that. Now it's having a restaurant-style kitchen. And the funny thing about those kitchens is that we are now actually cooking radically fewer meals than we used to, and eating at home much less than we used to. Even when we do eat at home, a lot of the things are like it's a chicken that you pick up that's already been roasted or takeout. So our kitchens, again, are becoming more and more elaborate, more and more expensive, the less and less we're actually cooking. Frankly, for an awful lot of people, they don't even really need a kitchen anymore. They can get by here in New York City. There are lots of people who don't really have kitchens. They have a little mini fridge. They have a microwave for heating up their takeout. They don't entertain at home. They go to restaurants. For lots of people, that big room that you're talking about could actually kind of send them on a guilt trip. You know, like I have this big kitchen. I have friends who have like gorgeous, gorgeous kitchens that are ready for the photo shoot, and they feel they never cook, and it makes them feel kind of guilty.
Well, having talked about living rooms and kitchens, I was surprised to discover that you're such an enthusiast about dining rooms. In fact, you even have a chapter heading that says, "How can your dining room help you live longer?"
The dining room was actually invented. It's kind of a Victorian invention that people dreamed up as a way of displaying status. People were spending more time socializing. This was in England. Social life gravitated around the country house. So people came and they had much more leisure time, and they were sitting around having these long meals. So they said, well, we better have like a really nice room to do that in, and let's get some nice silver and dishes and glassware and things to sort of show off to our friends and make the room beautiful. And what research shows now, actually, we don't like to think of ourselves as being attracted to status symbols, but status is a good predictor of your longevity. So that people who, for example, a very, very serious British epidemiologist did some research that showed that people who live in zip codes that are in quote-unquote better neighborhoods actually live a couple of years longer than people with the same socioeconomic profile otherwise who live in a different zip code. So if you can use your dining room in your home, I'm not talking about being snobby or, you know, keeping up with the Joneses or
just
but
to show
nice
off things that you take satisfaction in.
Yeah, and use nice things that remind you that these rituals are important and that you deserve the best. And, you know, why not? I live in New York, so I can pick up fabulous flowers now on any street corner for $5 or $6. This isn't a big deal. We don't have to like wait for Valentine's Day to have flowers on the table.
You know, you're absolutely right. And I think stopping for flowers is one of the nicest things one can do. But I also have to tell you that I never buy fresh flowers to go into the basement. And I'm perfectly happy in the basement.
Yeah, I'm not too keen on the basement myself, but it's my husband's favorite space in the house. He's crazy about it. A psychologist, Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi, the researcher who coined the term flow for optimum human experience, gave a lot of his research subjects beepers, and he would beep them randomly throughout the day, and they would have to record what they were doing, where they were, and how they felt. And he found that men were happiest in the basement, because for a lot of men, it's kind of their place. They don't have to take any instructions from their companions. And it's a place where that he might have a workbench or keep his tools or, you know, do other things that guys like to do. Women, it was their least favorite part of the house. Women in Csikszentmihalyi's study were happiest in the bathroom.
In the bathroom?
And as the mother of five kids, I can really understand that one. It is often the only room in a home that has a locking door. So when the world is too much with you, you can go into the bathroom, lock the door, run a tub, and no one can bother you for that magic 10 minutes.
And you have to be careful with them, too. I don't know whether you have run across anything like this. I just decided recently when I was in a store buying, I've forgotten what we were there for, a laundry basket or something, but I saw one of those fog-free mirrors. Mm-hmm. And decided I would put it up in the shower so that I could shave while standing there with the hot water pouring over me, which sounded like a really nice idea. I discovered it's not all that nice, actually, to see yourself when you're in the shower, however.
Bingo. Exactly. I think there's a strong correlation between the rise of our self-monitoring technology and the rise in things like anorexia, bulimia, body dysmorphic disorder. We have to remember that for most of history, until really relatively recently, people didn't have things like bathroom scales. Until the late 19th century, mirrors were very unusual. People didn't have them. So people just simply couldn't obsess about the way they looked. I'm in my 50s. Do I want to, the first thing in the morning, walk into the bathroom and look at a magnifying mirror? I really don't. Not before I have some coffee.
No,
So there's no reason why we have to turn our bathrooms into these laboratories filled with equipment. They really should be, you know, private sanctuaries where we can kind of relax and take care of ourselves.
Makes sense to me. Winifred Gallagher is a science writer and journalist. You'll find more of her thoughts about how to make a house feel right in her book, House Thinking, a room-by-room look at how we live. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast. You can buy a copy of the program by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for Design Green, program number 127A. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Charles Monroe Kane, with the help of Veronica Rickert, Doug Gordon, Anne Strainchamps, and Mary Lou Finnegan. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.